Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with Louis D'Souza on this Monday, April the 22nd, 2019. It is 8 a.m. in New York, 5 a.m. in Los Angeles, 1 p.m. in London, Sydney, Australia. I think you're around, I forgot to check the time today, but I think it's around 11 a.m. there, but wherever, or 11 p.m., wherever you are, whatever you are doing in the world, thank you for joining us for another episode of LOA Today, your daily dose of happy. And today is Richard Bach Day. Today is the day we are continuing our ongoing exploration of Illusions, a book that was published by Richard in the mid-1970s. It kind of took off, became almost a cult thing. It was just so widely followed. And what was it? What were the numbers that we found, Louis? We said that Illusions 2 came out, and how many people had bought Illusions 2?
That was about 66 million, I think.
Yeah, that's a fair number. I mean, that's like a,
that's, you know, Illusions 2, never mind Illusions 1.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And I'm sure it was all sold totally based on Illusions 1.
First book.
Yeah. So, you know, at least that many people bought it, probably in the hundreds of millions.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I've bought hundreds of copies and given it to other people.
Have you really? I haven't bought that many, no. I think I have two.
But year after year, I just, you know, whenever I purchase one, I don't purchase one. I purchase about seven or something.
Wow.
They all vanish, and then I buy another seven. And
that's pretty cool. But, yeah, to give that many away. And there's good reason for it, because I posted something in the Law of Attraction Changed My Life group to let people know, hey, you know, this is one podcast you want to make sure you're listening to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the topic. And oh, my cat is going to start chewing up paper. He decided he's going to be a pain in the neck. But I posted about it because this is a book that is really just remarkable in how accurate it is about law of attraction in what I would call the pre-LOA era, you know, before Abraham, before Seth Billy came in, before all this stuff started to really just explode like that. He was ahead of his time in that sense, which is pretty cool.
Way ahead of his time.
Yeah. Excuse me. I have to let my cat out, but just take a second while I'm letting my cat out to talk about why Illusions is such a great book from your perspective. Cause I mean, you can probably go on for 20 minutes about that, but you know, just take a minute.
Well, first of all, Illusions is a really short book, incredibly short. So it's easy to read. It's fantastically easy to read. And it resonates with you. You know, you really feel good reading it. And it's just an amazing, amazing book. So easy and quick to read. As I mentioned last time, I gave it to a lady, and she started reading it in the bath, and she never left the bath until about 3 o'clock in the morning, reading it from cover to cover, and was so excited by it. And it does that to you. It resonates with your source, and your source is saying, I agree with this, I agree with this, I agree with this. And you know, almost page after page after page, even though what it's saying is something that is quite incredible. In its lengths and breadths of what the accurate use of the law of attraction or clear use of the law of attraction can actually manifest for you, it just blows you away. It's like, wow, you know, we're in this LOA group and we're talking about manifesting a car. That's nothing besides swimming swimming in the ground or walking on water or flying.
Pretty crazy.
We haven't scraped the surface yet of what
this is true.
Possible.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That's something I was noticing over the weekend, how just in my own journey, I have a lot that I want to learn. I have a lot that I want to explore. And I started doing some exploration over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And it had, I guess I couldn't call it an unexpected result, because it really should have been expected, but it had a delightful result in that I felt really, really good after just making some attempts. Not that I succeeded in swimming in the ground or anything like that.
No.
But then, didn't quite get there. But, you know, just exploring this stuff made me feel.
A rookie, man.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I can tell you've been swimming in the ground. You got the dirt all over your hair.
Sorry, I have to go to wash again this morning.
Well, you see, you're supposed to do it. You did it the Richard way. The Richard way is just to swim in the earth and just kind of have to shake yourself off. The Donald Shimoda way.
Oh, yeah.
That's where you come out and just kind of flakes off of you.
Yeah. That's another level.
That's another level. That's right. Oh, my goodness. I just lost my copy. Oh, here it is. So, yes, we read chapter one or part one. I'm not sure, are these chapters or parts or whatever they are. But one of the cool things about this book, too, is that it's fiction. I mean, it's written as a fictional story, which is really, really cool because there aren't too many. I mean, there are probably a few out there, but there aren't too many law of attraction type, spiritual type books that are written in fiction form. I mean, you introduced me to one. There's this one, but I can't think of a whole lot of others beyond that, you know?
I can't either. Not with the clarity.
Not with the clarity.
So. And not that somebody who's taken Abraham Hicks stuff and put it into their own form.
Yes.
Of course, we're doing, and right. many other people are doing. So,
right.
Well, what I perceive the Abraham Hicks teachings is going to do, it's going to get lots of people like us and thousands of other people taking the law of attraction teaching that they've got and putting it in their own mold.
Mm.
And different people will be attracted to different molds, and then it'll all lead up to kind of the Abraham Hicks teaching.
your microphone just attacked you. That's great.
But what I really like is the idea of you know, the physical universe is really, we're on the leading edge, and
yes,
if somebody understood what that meant, they would start getting a lot more satisfied with where they're at.
No doubt about it. No doubt. And more people.
You're not striving to become perfect. You're not striving to achieve godlike state. You're not. You're now striving to know what you don't want, have a better idea what you do want. Game over.
That's it.
And enjoy both.
Yeah. It's basically recognizing that life is the ultimate ride. It's just this great, great ride. And the more that we appreciate that ride, the better the ride gets.
And Walt is glowing today. He's really riding. He's riding.
It's it. Oh, yeah.
It's good to see.
So anyway, first chapter one was kind of written in scriptural form, which is an interesting choice. Chapter two is where we actually get into the storyline, so to speak. And so I'll just read a bit of chapter two. We can, you know, break in the middle of it, but we'll just keep going. So I'll keep reading. Walt, it. Tell me what, you know.
If you don't mind, I just want to recap on the first section.
Yeah.
So you've got a story where you've got a mechanic who becomes enlightened, gets a huge following, asks God that he doesn't want to do this anymore. And God says, you know, not my will, but thy will be done. And he quits and he goes back into the world of man and machine, and this is where, back in the world of man and machine, that he bumps into Richard Bach.
And of course, chapter one, part one, is also where he told the story of the creature that clung to the bottom of the river and then decided to let go.
Yes.
Which is a very, very key law of attraction concept, the idea of letting go. And then once you do, everybody says, see, a creature like us, but he flies.
That's why Abram and I and many other people are like that. Actually, I think it's a Christian kind of statement that says, let go and let God.
Mm-hmm.
Let go and let source, more accurately, from my perspective. And you know, letting that power that is within you come out and letting it help guide you, which I think is amazing. Yeah.
It is amazing. It's amazing what happens when we do that. That's when all the wonderful craziness happens. That's the way I like to
describe it. That's where the confidence and the cockiness and the sugarness and the comes into it all.
And the most interesting and difficult and easy part of it, all in one kind of a big ball, is the more that we just let it go and do what it needs to do, the more it happens. The more we try to make it happen.
God. Yeah, yeah.
The more we try to make it happen, the less it happens because we just aren't as happy anymore. Which is a very interesting concept.
But you're supposed to work hard, study hard, and go.
Yes, right. Nose to the grindstone, absolutely. No, that nose to the grindstone doesn't work so well. I learned that one from personal experience. Kind of the hard
one. It's really interesting, but we really ingrained that it is the only way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and I catch myself in so many different circumstances with that vibrational premise fitting in. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my gosh. It comes in so many different forms, you have no idea.
Yeah, well, actually, I do have an idea. I tried the ball.
Oh boy.
And they are certainly self-defeating. So anyway, let's start the story. And feel free to jump in anytime while I'm reading. You know, if you see a good point to say, oh, here's a great thing to keep in mind. But it starts by saying, it was toward the middle of the summer that I met Donald Shimoda. In 4 years flying, I had never found another pilot in the line of work I do, flying with the wind from town to town, sailing rides in an old biplane, $3 for 10 minutes in the air. Boy, is that a 1970s price or what? $3 for 10 minutes in the air? Today, you're lucky if you can pay 30.
Times have changed.
Oh, yes. But one day, just north of Ferris, Illinois, I looked down from the cockpit of my fleet, and there was an old Travel Air 4000, gold and white, landed pretty as you please in the lemon emerald hay. Lemon emerald hay. Say that one 3 times fast. Mine's a free life, but it does get lonely sometimes. I saw the biplane there, thought about it for a few seconds, and decided it would be no harm to drop in. Throttle back to idle, a full rudder slip, and the fleet and I fell sideways toward the ground. Wind in the flying wires, that gentle good sound, the slow pock-pock of the old engine loafing its propeller around. Goggles up to better watch the landing. Corn stalks, a green leaf jungle swishing close below. Flicker of a fence, and then just cut hay as far as I could see. Stick and rudder out of the slip, a nice little roundout above the land, hay brushing the tires, then the familiar calm crashing rattle of hard ground under a wheel, slowing, slowing, and now a quick burst of noise and power to taxi beside the other plane and stop. Throttle back, switch off, the soft clack-clack of the propeller spinning down to stop in the total quiet of July. The pilot of the Travel Air sat in the hay, his back against the left wheel of his airplane, and he watched me. For a half minute, I watched him too, looking at the mystery of his calm. I wouldn't have been so cool just to sit there and watch another plane land in a field with me and park 10 yards away. I nodded, liking him, without knowing why. "You looked lonely," I said, across the distance between us. "So did you." "Don't mean to bother you. If I'm one too many, I'll be on my way." "No, I've been waiting for you." I smiled at that. "Sorry I'm late." "Well, that's all right." I pulled off my helmet and goggles, climbed out of the cockpit, and stepped to the ground. This feels good when you've been a couple of hours in the fleet. "Hope you don't mind ham and cheese," he said. "Ham and cheese and maybe an ant." No handshake, no introduction of any kind. He was not a large man. Hair to his shoulders, blacker than the rubber of the tire he leaned against. Eyes dark as hawk's eyes, the kind I like in a friend, and in anyone else, makes me feel uncomfortable indeed. He could have been a karate master on his way to some quietly violent demonstration. I accepted the sandwich and a thermos cup of water. "Who are you, anyway?" I said. "Years I've been hopping rides, never seen another barnstormer out in the fields." "Well, not much else I'm fit to do," he said, happily enough. "A little mechanicking, welding, roughneck a bit, skinning cats. I stay in one place too long, I get problems. So I made the airplane, and now I'm in the barnstorming business." "What kind of cat?" "I've been mad for diesel tractors since I was a kid. D8s, D9s, just for a little while in Ohio."
"D9s? Big as a house? Double compound low gear, can they really push a mountain?"
"Well, there are better ways of moving mountains," he said with a smile that lasted for maybe a tenth of a second. I like that. I leaned for a minute against the lower wing of his plane, watching him. A trick of the light, it was hard to look at the man closely, as if there were a light around his head, fading the background of faint misty silver. "Something wrong?" he asked. "What kind of problems did you have?" "Oh, nothing much. I just like to keep moving these days, same as you." I took my sandwich and walked around his plane. It was a 1928 or 29 machine, and it was completely unscratched. Factories don't make airplanes as new as his was parked there in the hay. 20 coats of hand-rubbed beauty-rate dope, at least. Paint like a mirror pulled tight over the wooden ribs of the thing. Don, an old English gold leaf under the rim of his cockpit. And the registration on the map case said D.W. Shimoda. The instruments were new out of the box. Original 1928 flight instruments. Varnished oak. Control stick and rudder bar, throttle mixture, spark advance at the left. You never see spark advances anymore, even on the best restored antiques. No scratch anywhere, not a patch on the fabric, not a single streak of engine oil from the cowling, not a blade of straw on the floor of the cockpit as though his machine hadn't flown at all but
instead had materialized on the spot through some time warp across a half century. I felt an odd, creepy cold on my neck. "How long have you been hopping passengers?" I called across the plane to him. "Oh, about a month now, 5 weeks." He was lying. 5 weeks in the fields, and I don't care who you are. You've got dirt and oil on the plane, and there's straw on the cockpit floor no matter what. But this machine, no oil on the windshield, no flying haze stains on the leading edges of the wings and tail, no bugs smashed on the propeller. That is not possible for an airplane flying through an Illinois summer. I studied the travel air another 5 minutes, and then I went back and sat down in the hay under the wing facing the pilot. I wasn't afraid. I still liked the guy, but something was wrong. "Why are you not telling me the truth?" "I have told you the truth, Richard," he said. The name is painted on my airplane, too. "A person does not hop passengers for a month in a travel air without getting a little oil on the plane, my friend. A little dust, one patch in the fabric, hay, for God's sake, on the floor." He smiled calmly at me. "There are some things you do not know." In that moment, he was a strange, other planet person. I believed what he said, but I had no way of explaining his Joule airplane parked out in the summer hayfield. "Well, this is true, but someday I'll know them all. And then you can have my airplane down because I won't need it to fly." He looked at me with interest and raised his black eyebrows. "Oh, tell me." I was delighted. Someone wanted to hear my theory. "People couldn't fly for a long time, I don't think, because they didn't think it was possible. So, of course, they didn't learn the first little principle of aerodynamics. I want to believe that there's another principle somewhere. We don't need airplanes to fly or move through walls or get to planets. We can learn how to do that without machines anywhere, if we want to." He half smiled, seriously, and nodded his head one time. "And you think that you will learn what you wish but to learn by hopping $3 rides out of hayfields?" "Well, the only learning that's mattered is what I got on my own, doing what I want to do. There isn't, but if there were a soul on earth who could teach me more of what I want to know than my airplane can and the sky, I'd be off right now to find him. Or her." The dark eyes looked at me level. "Don't you believe you're guided if you really want to learn this thing?" "Well, I'm guided, yes. Isn't everyone? I've always felt something kind of watching over me, sort of." "And you think you'll be led to a teacher who can help you?" "Well, if the teacher doesn't appear to me, yes." "Well, maybe that's the way it happens," he said. A modern new pickup truck hushed down the road toward us, raising a thin brown fog of dust, and it stopped by the field. The door opened, an old man got out, and a girl of 10 or so. The dust stayed in the air. It was that still. "Selling rides, are you?" said the man. The field was Donald Shimoda's discovery, so I stayed quiet. "Yes, sir," he said brightly. "Feel like flying, do you, today?" "If I did, you cut any diddos, turn any flip-flops with me up there?" The man's eyes twinkled, watching to see if we knew him behind his country bumpkin talk. "Well, if you won't, well, if you want, won't if you don't. And I suppose you want the dear Lord's fortune." "$3 cash, sir, for 9-10 minutes in the air. That is 33 1/3 cents per minute, and worth it, most people tell me." It was an odd bystander feeling to sit there, listen, idle and listen to the way this fellow worked his trade. I liked what he said, all low-key. I had grown so used to my own way of selling rides. "Guaranteed 10 degrees cooler upstairs, folks. Come on up where only birds and angels fly. All of this for only $3 a dozen quarters from your purse or pocket." I had forgotten there might be another way. There's a tension flying and selling rides alone. I was used to it, but still it was there. If I don't fly passengers, I don't eat. Now, when I could sit back, not depending on my dinner for the outcome, I relaxed for once and watched. The girl stood back and watched too. Blonde, brown-eyed, solemn-faced, she was here because her grandpa was. She did not want to fly. Most often, it's the other way around. Eager kids and cautious adults. But one gets a sense for these things when it's one's livelihood, and I knew that girl wouldn't fly with us if we waited all summer. "Which one of you gentlemen?" the man said. Shimoda poured himself a cup of water. "Richard will fly you. I'm still on my lunch hour, unless you want to wait." "No, sir. I'm ready to go. Can we fly over my farm?" "Sure," I said. "Just point the way you want to go, sir."
I dumped my bedroll and tool bag and cook pots from the front cockpit of the fleet, helped the man into the passenger seat and buckled him in. And then I slid down into the rear cockpit and flat fastened my own seatbelt. Give me a prop, will you, Don?
Yep.
He brought his water cup with him and stood by the propeller. What do you want? Hot and brakes. Pull it slow. The impulse will take it right out of your hand. Always, when somebody pulls the fleet propeller, they pull it too fast, and for complicated reasons, the engine won't start. But this man pulled it around ever so slowly, as though he had done it forever. The impulse spring snapped, sparks fired in the cylinder, and the old engine was running that easy. He walked back to his airplane, sat down, and began talking to the girl. In a great burst of raw horsepower and flying straw, the fleet was in the air, climbing through 100 feet. If the engine quits now, we land in the corn, 500 feet now, and we can turn back and land in the hay, and now it's the cow pasture west, 800 feet in level, following the man's finger, pointing through the wind southwest. 3 minutes airborne, and we circle the farmstead, barns the color of glowing coals, house of ivory in a sea of mint, a garden and back for food, sweet corn and lettuce and tomatoes growing. The man in the front cockpit looked down through the air as we circled the farmhouse framed between the wings and through the flying wires of the fleet. A woman appeared on the porch below, white apron over blue dress, waving, and the man waved back. They would talk later of how they could see each other so well across the sky. He looked back at me finally with a nod to say, that was enough, thanks, and we could head back now. I flew a wide circle around Ferris to let the people know there was flying going on, and spiraled down over the hayfield to show them just where it was happening. And as I slipped down to land, banked steeply over the corn, the travel air swept off the ground and turned at once toward the farm we had just left. Louie, I think we lost your video. There we go. I flew once with a five-ship circus, and for a moment it was that kind of busy feeling of one plane lifting off with passengers while another lands. We touched the ground with a gentle rumbling crash and rolled to the far end of the hay by the road. The engine stopped, the man unsnapped his safety belt, and I helped him out. He took a wallet from his overalls and counted the dollar bill, shaking his head. That's quite a ride, son. Well, we think so. It's a good product we're selling. It's your friend that's selling. Oh? I'll say. Your friend could sell ashes to the devil, I'll wager, can't he now? Well, how can you say that? Well, the girl, of course, an airplane ride for my daughter, Sarah. As he spoke, he watched the travel air, a distant silver mote in the air circling the farmhouse. He spoke as a calm man speaks, noting the dead twig in the yard had just sprouted blossoms and ripe apples. Since she's born, that girl's been wild to death about high places. Screams, just terrified. Sarah'd no more climb a tree than she'd stir a hornet's bare hand. Won't climb the ladder to the loft, won't go up there if the flood was rising in the yard. The girl's a wonder with machines, not too bad around animals, but heights, they are a caution to her. And there she is up in the air. He talked on about this and other special times. He remembered when the barnstormers used to come through Galesburg years ago in Monmouth, flying two-wingers the same as we flew, but doing all kinds of crazy stunts with them. I watched the distant travel air get bigger, spiral down over the field in a bank steeper than I'd ever fly with a girl afraid of heights, slip over the corn and fence and touch the hay in a three-point landing that was dazzling to watch. Donald Shimoda must have been flying for a good long while to land a travel air that way. The airplane rolled to a stop beside us, no extra power required, and the propeller clanked softly to a stop. I looked closely. There were no bugs on the propeller. Not so much as a single fly killed on that 8-foot blade. I sprang to help, unshackled the girl's safety belt, opened the little front cockpit door for her, and showed her where to step so her foot wouldn't go through the wing fabric. How'd you like that? I said. She didn't even know I spoke. Grandpa, I'm not afraid. I wasn't scared, honest. And the house looked like a little toy, and Mom waved at me, and Don said I was scared just because I fell and died once, and I don't have to be afraid anymore. I'm going to be a pilot, Grandpa. I'm going to have an airplane and work on the engine myself and fly everywhere and give rides. Can I do that? Donald Shimoda smiled at the man and shrugged his shoulders. Well, he told you you were going to be a pilot, did he, Sarah? No, but I am. I'm already good with engines, you know that. Well, you can talk about that with your mother. Time for us to be getting home. The two thanked us, and one walked, one ran to the pickup truck, both changed by what happened in the field and in the sky. Two automobiles arrived, then another, and we had a noon rush of people who wanted to see Ferris from the air. We flew 12, 13 flights as fast as we could get them off, and after that I made a run to the station in town to get car gas for the fleet. Then a few passengers, a few more, and it was evening, and we flew solid back-to-back flights till sunset. A sign somewhere said population 200, and by dark I was thinking we had flown them all, and some out-of-towners as well. I forgot in the rush of flying to ask about Sarah and what Don had told her, whether he had made up the story or if he thought it was true about dying. And every once in a while, I watched his plane closely while passengers changed seats. Not a mark on it. No oil drop anywhere. And he apparently flew to dodge the bugs that I had to wipe off my windshield every hour or two. There was just a little light in the sky when we quit. By the time I laid dry corn stalks in my tin stove, set them over with charcoal bricks and lit the fire, it was full dark, the firelight throwing colors back from the airplanes parked close and from the golden straw about us. I peered into the grocery box. "Well, it's soup or stew or SpaghettiOs," I said, "or pears or peaches. Want some hot peaches?" "Oh, no difference," he said mildly. "Anything or nothing." "Man, aren't you hungry? This has been a busy day." "Well, you haven't given me much to be hungry for, unless that's good stew." I opened the stew can with my Swiss Air Officer's escape and evasion knife, did a similar job on the SpaghettiOs, and popped both cans over the fire. My pockets were tight with cash. This was one of the pleasanter times of day for me. I pulled the bills out and counted, not bothering much to fold them flat. It came to $147, and I figured in my head, which is not easy for me. Let's see. Four and carry the two. 49 flights today. Broke $100 a day. Broke $100 a day, Don. Just me and the fleet. You must have broke 200 easy. You fly mostly two at a time, right? Mostly, he said. About this teacher you're looking for. I ain't looking for a teacher, I said. I'm counting money. I can go a week on this. I can be rained out cold for one solid week. He looked at me and smiled. When you were done swimming in your money, he said, would you mind passing the stew? This Donald Shimoda character is a very cool customer, Louis.
Very cool.
Nothing much phases him. When you read that chapter the first time, and you read the story about the granddaughter who had a fear of flying, and Donald Shimoda attributed it to a past death experience.
Yeah.
What did you think of that the first time?
Well, you'll have to go through my history. When was the first time I read it? So I was brought up in the book as a kid. So I don't think I thought too much of it then. I don't think I liked the book as... I think I wasn't brought up as a kid with that book. I was brought up with The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, which I highly recommend to anybody. Mm-hmm. But I think my mentor gave it to me at the age of 21. So when I read it then, I'd already started to look at reincarnation and karma. So to me, it wasn't, I hadn't had my own reincarnation experiences by then. So, I probably would have just thought it was quite interesting, quite a new idea, because I was breaking away from Christianity at that stage, and looking at many other religions and groups. So I probably don't remember exactly how I felt, but it probably would have been something like, "Oh, this confirms what I think is the way it is."
Oh, okay.
Well, that's a long, complicated answer to something.
No, that's fine. That's fine. And actually, I'm going to have to follow up in a moment about one comment you made, because you kind of left a thought dangling in the air, and I can't let that dangle there. But my own reaction when I first read it was skepticism. Like, I'm enjoying this story. This is a fun story. I can tell. Yeah. He's a good writer. But, this is like one of those suspend your disbelief times, and I'm not really ready to suspend my disbelief, so I'll just skip it for now.
Okay.
That was my reaction. But the thought that you left hanging, dangling in the air there was when you said, when you had your own reincarnation experiences for the first time. Hmm. And I say that you left it dangling partly because people who teach the idea of reincarnation say most of us have been reincarnating over and over again. And here you are saying that you reincarnated for the first time, but you also said you did it during your lifetime. So there's a special story there, and I'm wondering what the story is.
I think it was maybe a misinterpretation of what I was saying. My first reincarnation experience, not my first lifetime of remembering my first incarnation into the physical contrasting universe.
Ah, okay.
Okay. I don't think I'd really want to remember when I was a diamond or... I think, yeah, never mind.
It's not exactly a thrilling lifetime.
No, though. No, I don't know what I say. Well, I was still for a long time.
I was sparkling and sparkling.
I didn't vibrate much at all. Couldn't wait for my vibrations.
Ah, sparkle, sparkle. Okay. But what was it like when you remembered your first, or when you first remembered? What did you say you remembered your very first reincarnation, or that you first remembered reincarnation?
I had my first past life experience. That might be a clearer way of explaining it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And that I kind of presume was a bit life changing.
It's complicated because it is a very, very specific experience, very, very clear experience. And it seemed to be me in a past life. That seemed to be quite clear.
Mm-hmm.
But again, once you start understanding the entire nature of reincarnation and karma, you start looking at it very differently to the way then. The way I looked at it then is this was a past life. I was in India. I was sitting in the lotus position. I had I was a snake charmer, and I had this bowl thing, and I was playing my flute and the or whatever it was, and not that I can play an instrument this lifetime, but you know, I understood yoga, I understood the body well, and when I walked into this life, I could do very advanced yoga moves that not even one single yoga teacher, except maybe one. I never really asked her if she could do it or not, but she probably could, my main yoga teacher. But I've never met a yoga teacher, I think, that can do it, except maybe that one. So being born with very advanced yoga abilities and not actually being particularly interested in yoga this lifetime whatsoever. It was something like, actually, I don't want yoga this lifetime in the beginning. Now, I'll use it and I'll play with it because I'm able to distance myself from all the stuff that came with yoga in the past. I think there's a lot of other things that come with it, traditions and routine rituals, et cetera, et cetera. So once that was all stripped away from me, or I did it myself, I stripped away all the other stuff out of yoga, and I realized yoga is far more than the hatha yoga, which is the physical yoga. So, you know, my first experience of another lifetime was the one I mentioned. Then I had others and others and others and others with other people as well that are in this lifetime that were also in that one, and I started to put bits and pieces together. Now I don't have any past life experiences at all because I start seeing it as everything's in the now and there really isn't any past life at all. And it's more, if you wanted to look at it in a more accurate way, you're kind of looking at parallel lives rather than, past lives. But it's very difficult for a human in a time-space reality to perceive everything as now, the only thing is now. And because we see ourselves grow from small to old and all the rest of it, we kind of see a time frame. And of course, Donald Shimoda, Richard Bach, Donald Shimoda, is pointing out that we don't have to live by any of those standards. We can grow to a young adult type body and stay like that forever. That's the implication of what they're saying with the biplane. It's not necessary to age. And the only thing that ages you is.
Oh, is this a, this is a question. Oh, this is a quiz. Oh, okay. Yeah. My thought process. And it's me. I'm not just doing it.
And what is the thoughts that age you?
I'm still working on the answer to that one. I know that there's a list at this point, but tell me what your list is.
No, not specific. I'm talking about general. So I'm saying...
Oh, anything that doesn't feel good. Anything that's focusing on what I don't like.
Focus on what you don't want. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
So any mental thought that is focused on what you don't want ages you. So I've just given humanity on this amazing podcast the secret to endless longevity. Looking good, younger, fitter, happier is...
Feeling good.
Thinking
and feeling good. Whatever you're focusing on, what you're feeling good about, you're on the right track. By the way, Susie had a nice comment for you. She says, I know what Louis is talking about. I had a very similar experience during a sound healing session. By bringing those lifetimes into the present, it really helped me to understand the energy around a serious health problem and got me on the path to healing myself, by myself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Susie, there's an interesting aspect of your story that I wanted to clarify in a way. You might understand this, but I went to a reincarnation seminar, and the guy kept on saying, you know, it's good. You can do this method and that method to experience your past lives and on and on. I put my hand up, and I said, why do you want to experience past lives? Being devil's advocate as usual, specifically when at that age I was quite and because I'd gone through this whole idea in my head, why you want to experience past lives. Now Susie's example is perfect example of why you want to experience past lives, and Donald Shimoda's story is the perfect example of why. He said to her, in a past life, you died knowing what you don't want. So now when you're clear about what you don't want, you can now move to what you do want. All right. So it's all about the expansion. And Susie was talking about how she expanded out of it. And I love that aspect. And that is a useful reason for you to go and look into past lives. So I had a lady when I was in my 20s to 30s who, whenever she came in contact with me, whenever, she would go red in the face.
Really?
Completely red in the face. And she knew there was a sexual thing whenever she was around me, and she didn't understand that she was married and had a kid and all the rest of it. And she was really, really confused about this. And then she was given a past life showing her that her and I were together. And we had had a very sexual lifetime together. And whenever she saw me in this lifetime, it kind of brought those feelings up. So it was quite confusing for her. But after the experience, it kind of clarified the whole thing. So, you know, I'm glad it did, because I didn't have somebody coming up to me with this red face anymore.
Yeah, right.
Because it happened for years until she had sorted that out. You know, it was really interesting. It was really, really interesting experiences that you can have with other people about past lives, et cetera. So a good reason to experience them is just to grow in the now, is to expand. And the way Abram puts it is very interesting, because, you know, I like that story that I've told people, Walt, where when I was at school, high school, I had this most boring history teacher. How much time we got? Yeah.
Oh, we're fine.
This boring history teacher. And this history teacher said, open your book and then answer the questions at the back, close it, goodbye. And that was literally it. And she was just dead. You know, it was one of those lifeless individuals. At that stage, I came to the understanding that the only thing we learn from history is we don't learn from history, and that was about it. It was game over. And then an amazing thing happened. A young, fit, vivacious guy comes into the class, takes over, and he teaches us the French Revolution, and I was absolutely enthralled with it. And jokingly, at the end of this incredible story about King Louis and Marie Antoinette and all her shoes and the kid and the beheading and all the stuff that went on, I called myself after that jokingly for many years until something happened, which is another story. It's a good one.
I'm sure.
That I called myself King Louis.
Oh, really?
I related so much with Louis of France that I jokingly always called myself King Louis. I mean, people said to me afterwards, oh, I thought it was because of the Lion King or this or that or something else. No, no, no. It was specifically because of King Louis the 16th.
Now you realize you were identifying with somebody who lost his head, right?
Yeah, I know. I was always wondering why I had that crick in my neck, but it now makes sense. So I don't know if you know Marie Antoinette, but
not personally.
She was no. Oh, no. I missed that lifetime.
Yeah.
Have some more past life experiences.
No, I was just one of the French peasants who was complaining about the royalty and wanting to get their heads off or something like that.
So, yeah, Maria was a daughter of Queen of Austria.
Mm.
And she made a lot of peace in Europe because she married her 9 daughters or whatever off to the entire Europe. So she managed to create a lot of stability during her lifetime. And one of her daughters was Marie Antoinette.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the mother's name, the queen's name was Maria. So what happened was I married a Austrian lady whose name was Annette.
Uh-huh.
And her mother's was Maria.
That's why.
And we both have a strong connection and feeling towards that French Revolution and time period and story.
That's interesting.
So was I King Louis at one stage? Who cares? Doesn't really matter. But I associate with the vibration of it. Mm-hmm. I even brought a teacher into my reality that taught me it in a great, fantastic way.
Right.
I married a wife who's got a similar name and comes from the same country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her mother was Maria, who also is a bit of a matriarch who runs the whole show.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, it all fitted together. It was just amazing to me when you start putting the pieces together of past life and current life.
It is amazing. This is kind of tied into something I was learning over the weekend. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the other co-hosts who do the show with me Monday through Friday, but Bill G does the Tuesday show with me and with Alex King. And he's been introducing us to a modality he likes called SRT, stands for Spiritual Response Therapy. And it's basically a way of using a pendulum to connect on an intuitive level to higher spirit and so forth and communicate and clear problems and all kinds of stuff like that.
So pendulums have been used forever.
Oh, yes. And so I've been kind of dabbling in it, kind of learning it. I like I told him, I didn't really know why I was doing it. I was just kind of doing it because I just felt like, okay, let's go do this. But I couldn't give a clear reason for doing it. Anyway, over the weekend, I've been doing some experimenting. I've been practicing with it, trying to learn how to use it consistently and get consistent results. And it occurred to me that, this is actually something I brought up to him. It occurred to me that so much of what gets focused on in this SRT therapy thing is all about negative stuff, whole lots of negative stuff. It's about getting rid of all these negatives that are in your way and all that kind of thing. And I started thinking about it from an Abraham perspective, thinking about, well, you know, that's a whole lot of focusing on what I don't want. It would be a whole lot better if I focused on what I do want. And in the midst of exploring that, I had that moment of clarity that said, ah, this is like all of the different tools. There are a whole bunch of tools that are out there or tools or practices, you know, things like, you know, going into past lives, all that kind of thing that exist for us to do a couple things. First, to go into the contrast and decide what it is we like, what it is we don't like. Mm-hmm. And secondly, to learn from them and decide, okay, where are we going to go with it? What do we want to do next? And that is one of the big themes of illusions. Yeah. I mean, we haven't gotten there yet in the book, but Richard learns fairly quickly, I think it's in the next couple of chapters, that we are here for doing two things and two things only, to learn and to have fun.
Mm.
Because yes,
I taught that to my daughter at a young age. I said, why are we here? We're here to learn and have fun.
Yeah.
I said, you can give me any other reason you want, but they will fall into those two categories.
Right. Exactly. So when you look at your experience with past lives, you were doing some combination of that too. You were learning, you were having fun.
you were enjoying it. And in fact, when you got into the French Revolution part, you were really having fun. You were having a blast learning this thing. You'd attracted in this teacher who was just fascinating to you, was able to tell stories in a great way that just drew you right in.
He felt French, and he had really, really tight pants on showing everything. And he had this little bit of naffness to him, and it was so cool.
That's so funny.
Different, you know.
Yeah,
this is an Afrikaans Dutch Reform type church in Salah. Church ran the school, you know.
Right.
Where I came from, we stood and sang the national anthem before we went into our classes every morning at school. You know, it was a different world.
Hey, that still happens here in the U.S., but that's another topic. We won't get into that
another
today.
Topic.
when I'm thinking about illusions and the first chapter that we read there, and how he basically in this, it's actually the second chapter of the book. He's introducing us to the character Donald Shimoda. He's establishing himself as being the author. I mean, the author is pretty much autobiographical in that character, Richard. And that's pretty clear too. And he's starting to lay out this guy, Donald, that he ran into in this storyline is a really fascinating character. And that's kind of what I'm leading up to when I'm talking about all this stuff. You talked about this great guy who was a really fascinating character who told you the story about the French Revolution. Same thing happening here in Illusions. Richard talking about this really fascinating character who's about to tell him some absolutely mind-blowing stories. And what's the most cool part of all is the French Revolution is talking about stuff that, I mean, you can probably draw a law of attraction lessons from, but Richard Bach's story is law of attraction.
Every step of the way.
And that's what's so fun about it. So, like when I was talking about my exploration of SRT over the weekend, I came to that realization. This is all about learning law of attraction. And in learning law of attraction, we're learning how to pick what are the things that we like, separate them from the things that we don't like, focus on those things that we like. And that's what it's all about. So literally, I mean, one of the things that you do with SRT is they have these charts that you use your pendulum on to kind of measure, okay, you know, here's what's going on. Here's the thing you need to know about. So I said, well, how many positive charts are there in SRT? In fact, I asked Bill that on Friday. Friday, Bill came out with Linda Armstrong, and that was one of the questions I asked him. And he says, well, he actually named two charts. It's chart 19 and 6A or something like that. I forget what it was. And I actually looked in the book, and sure enough, those were the only two positive charts. All the rest of them were all this terrible stuff going on. Well, I was thinking about that, and I said to myself, why couldn't I make my own chart? And so I did. I made a chart based on Abraham's 22-step emotional guidance scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I started playing with it. And I wasn't sure what to do with it. You know, I had no purpose. You know, it was just like, let's just create a chart and see what happens. So I used Adobe Illustrator, and I created a chart and printed it out. Nice, neat-looking chart. And I started playing with it. And I didn't even know what to do. So I started using the pendulum. I said, so, chart, tell me where I am on the scale right now. And, you know, went right to the point on the scale where I was. It was perfect. I loved it. And I said,
and where was that?
Let's see. I can tell you. If I look at the scale, I always forget the different. It was at the positive expectation / belief, which is the fourth point down from the top. Yeah, so I was in a pretty good place. And so I said to myself, "Well, gee, I wonder if I can use this tool to find the scale."
That's where you were at when you asked the question, or is that where you're at on average?
That's where I was when I asked the question.
Right. Okay.
Right. And then I asked myself, well, Abraham teaches, you know, you want to climb the scale one step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, can I use SRT to climb the scale?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea how to go about doing that. But I asked the question using the yes-no graph, and the graph came back, yes, you could do that. It's like, okay, let's give it a shot. What do I do? I had no idea what to do. So I just tried something. I don't even remember exactly what I tried. I just tried something, and I took a measurement. And when I took a measurement, literally about a minute later, I found I'd gone up one step on the scale. So now I was at enthusiasm / eagerness / happiness. And I thought to myself, cool. What I've just demonstrated to myself is that I took a tool, this SRT tool, and I used it as a way to climb the Abraham scale, which is exactly what Abraham teaches us.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly what we teach. You know, so all of these tools are all about us learning how to climb the scale, learning how to be deliberate creators, learning how to select what we want and select out what we don't want and say, yes, I want that, and no thank you on that. It's what all this stuff is. And that's what I see Illusions as. Mm. When I first read Illusions, I was confused by it. I was intrigued by it. I didn't know what to make of it. But now looking back, I understand this is another tool. This is another tool for deciding what it is that I want and what it is that I don't want. And it's a wonderful tool for that.
It is. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So that was my big insight. That's why I came on the show today. I felt great because of that experience.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. So I wanted to break this down for you just so from my perspective is what you're doing when you're using a pendulum is you're trying to learn to communicate with your non-physical self.
Right.
Your source energy. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Your vortex that knows everything that you want. All right. So do you have to use a pendulum or can you just listen to, does it feel good? Does it not feel good?
That's an interesting question. I mean, because ultimately Abraham would teach, and I think it's true, that you can just listen to how you feel.
Mm.
One of the reasons I was intrigued by the idea of using the pendulum is that I know what it's like to express the idea that I'm not sure how I feel. Like, I know I'm feeling okay-ish, but if I tried to pick my, sometimes if I try to pick out a point on the scale.
How I feel clearly is quite a clear emotion that you're not in the best place.
Well, that much I knew. Yeah. I knew I was somewhere around this area, but picking exactly where I was on the scale was kind of tough to pick. So I figured, I wonder if I can help myself learn to tune in better by using the pendulum. And that's ultimately what my question was. I didn't know it at the time, but that's what I was trying to figure out. Can I use the pendulum to help me kind of calibrate my understanding of how I'm feeling at any given moment?
And of course you can. There are millions of tools out there, and the law of attraction will bring you the appropriate ones for you.
Right.
Okay. And none of them are wrong.
Right.
That's what I love about Abraham Hicks' teaching. None of them are wrong.
Yep. Okay.
They're all right. And the law of attraction is going to bring the more appropriate one to your door because you're going to
exactly.
be in a vibrational sync to it.
Exactly.
So it's important to know that all these different tools, they all can work. And the basic thing that you need to keep inside of you with great clarity is that your source energy is your guidance and your source energy is a vortex of what you want. And that vortex of what you want wants to help you get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll give you positive emotion if you're heading the right way. It'll give you negative emotion if you're heading away from it. And that's why you might feel completely different to exactly the same subject and question that I have.
Right.
Because your vortex wants to send you to where everything you want. And what's in your vortex of what you want is different to what's in my vortex of what I want.
Exactly.
So it might give you a different one. So therefore, the important thing to understand is that each individual has their own unique guidance system.
That's right.
And when you understand that, you understand that other people's opinion is not anywhere near as valid as your emotional guidance opinion. They might be good as a sounding board to get for one or other reason, but it's a complete relearning to trust yourself rather than other people, getting your children not to believe in the parents so much, but to believe in themselves more.
And you see the same thing on Facebook. You see people who post, you know, I'm trying to do X, whatever X is, it's important to me, but I need some vibes. Send me some positive vibes so that I can do X. And every time I see that, I want to say the same thing. The best vibes come within you. Connect to yourself. Connect to your own feelings. You'll get the vibes a whole lot more powerful than anything else anybody else can send you.
But people will tend to rise to your level of expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And your level of expectation is if you send them positive vibes, it will help them.
Oh, yeah, it does. I'm not saying it doesn't. Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, I can see, depending on how you look at it, you can really use that as a positive tool.
Sure.
And it's not something I fight against anymore, but I now see the way that they want to use it. It's where they're at and the way they think it's going to be best for them. And yeah, I send them positive vibes and hey, cool, man, ride the wave of the expectation that I have and go for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know I don't have to type in the Facebook, you know, I'm sending you positive vibes. I just have to think it because that's how it actually works. It's not actually typing.
Right.
So I can do it quickly and easily without even going anywhere, but I know we've got 5 minutes left, so probably need to wrap up there.
No, that's all right. We actually have an extra minute beyond that because we started a minute later.
This is one thing I wanted to say. Don't you believe you're guided if you really want to learn a thing?
Mm.
So what he's saying is, don't you believe that there's a vortex and the vortex wants to take you to where you want to go?
Yeah, that's basically it.
That is basically it.
I hadn't actually equated that until you said it just now. Yeah. That was essentially the same thing as the Abraham vortex, but it is.
Yes, it is. And, you know, when your student is ready, the master appears. It's all the same thing.
Yep.
And the master is always ultimately yourself, because your point of attraction is going to bring the appropriate person, not the other way around.
Isn't that interesting? Because we so often look outside ourselves for the master, but the master is actually inside.
Do you know, I had a fantastic statement from a good friend of mine in South Africa the other day. And he said to me, you know, I've noticed something that you've been saying, that everybody seems to be realizing that they are their own guides. And I see that so much recently. And I was like, yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. You know, I hadn't quite noticed that, but I'm seeing that a lot myself. But again, I know my point of attraction is going to bring people who think likely similar to me. So, but it is something I'm coming across quite a lot at the moment, is that people are starting to realize that they have their own guidance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. It's really all about learning to trust your own guidance and to recognize it for what it is.
And what Walt was trying to do with that Facebook post, he was trying to say, you know, turn in and look at your own guidance.
Yeah.
And look at your own guidance.
It's all right there.
Which is something that we're not, as humans, it's not something we're programmed to do.
It's true.
We haven't got that active vibration going there.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. We are learning how. More and more of us are learning. We're learning to trust it. We're learning to connect. Yeah. And it's a growing number, and it's exciting too. I like that. I like that fact a lot. I do want to take a couple minutes before we finish the podcast up today to remind people that if you're not yet a subscriber, please become one. It's very simple to do. We've got links in, if you're listening to the live stream, we've got links in the post where you're seeing this. If you are listening to the podcast, we've got links in there as well. Just click on the right link for your particular device. But if you can't find the links, they just aren't anywhere that you can find, just go to the homepage of our website, loatoday.net. And right there at the top of the page, you will see a link that is designed especially for your device, because it's actually smart. It's a smart page, Louie, a page that actually knows what kind of device you've got and shows you the right one right there. You just click it. It's like a one option choice. You just click the one option and it just walks you right through it, which is pretty cool.
You have the enlightened website.
The enlightened website. That's right. I don't have like a little flash of light whenever you push the button.
It knows what you want.
And of course, once you become a subscriber, you know, share the fact that you're subscribing actually as you're listening to this episode and other episodes. Just share the fact that you're listening so that more and more people can get their daily doses of happy. And that's our multi-dimensional message that we try to put out in every episode. And I've done it again here. So my day is complete, Louie. I've got the message out. So with the last minute or so that we've got left, what's your big takeaway? What's the one thing that you think people should remember more than anything else from this chapter?
From this chapter? I'm tempted to say something, but I'll skip it. A little more explanation. So, you know, your guidance system, you know, everybody has their own guidance system. Tune in, listen to how you feel, and care more intensely about that than anything. And you know, that's really Abraham Hicks slant on it. But, you know, it was coming through very, very clearly in this chapter.
I agree with you, yeah. And I would say Abraham Hicks and Richard Bach are completely on the same wavelength anyway, so you can kind of interchange one for the other. It's just different words more than anything else.
Yeah. Jerry was often talking about the book as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. That was one of his influences, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I remember that. So, okay, well, this has been good. We will carry on with chapter three or part three or whatever you want to call third part. Next week. But in the meantime, Louie, have a wonderful week.
You
Enjoy
too.
Yourself. Yeah. Thanks also to our live stream listeners and to our podcast listeners as well. And we will see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Take care. Carpe diem.